ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The economy, stupid, is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Maher, coming to you from Gadigal land. Dame Harriet Walter swept into the LNL studio in May with the dragon face of ex-Mrs. Logan Roy in the TV hit Succession and talked Shakespeare. After playing so many of Shakespeare's women, she's written about the lives they might have lived if he'd given them a few more lines. But first, 'tis the season for the South Pole. In the old days, a few scientists used to make the journey every summer. But in 2024, 125,000 tourists went to Antarctica. It's quite straightforward once you pay out a fortune for your tickets. Then you fly to South America, hop on a boat for a very bumpy ocean crossing, and within a couple of days, you're walking with penguins, listening to humpbacks roar, and watching icebergs drift by in a bright blue sea. This pristine world is protected by treaty, and tourism operators insist they follow all the rules. But as the numbers of tourists grow year by year, there's a growing concern about the impact on the Antarctica of so many people. Can hundreds of boats really sail these waters and hundreds of thousands of people clamber ashore without harming the place? Professor Anne Hardy leads the Antarctic Tourism Research Program at the University of Tasmania. And to discuss that question, she joins me now. Anne, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much for having me.
Anne, I haven't. You have been there. What's it like?
Oh, it's a beautiful place. I think the way that you described it is really great, was quite perfect. It's a magnificent, mountainous, bright, harsh, exhilarating environment down there. It's a place that I can barely describe. You feel like you're in a bit of a lonely club after you've been down there because it's such a magnificent place and your senses are so heightened because of the brightness and the coldness and the sharpness and the clarity of the air. So it's a really profound place to be able to visit.
Who goes there?
That's a good question. I mean, as you mentioned before, traditionally it was all about scientific endeavor and discovery when, you know, up until about the 1950s. And then after the 1950s, tourism began. And at the beginning, it was, you know, tourists on often retrofitted icebreakers who went down there. But in the last 10 years, the type of person that goes down there has really changed. We've seen large ships that are actually built specifically for the conditions to break through the ice, be steady in the high seas, but keep the passengers comfortable. And the prices are coming down. So some people go there, the people who go there are people who have had a long-term interest and love of Antarctica. Other people who go down there are really motivated to just see the seventh continent and sort of they're what we might call bucket listers. And there are other people who go down there for they're really interested in last chance tourism to see the place that they believe is in trouble. And we also have people who go down there who are having a profound experience in their life. They might be towards the end of their life. They might have just suffered a massive loss and they're the types of people who go down there to really, sharpen their sense of living and live out a dream at the same time.
I know a few people have been there and they all come back filled with wonder. They seem to be changed in some way. Does it change people? Does the effect last?
Yes, I think it does. I think the experience is so different that I think for many people it can change the way that they see the world. And the reason why is that it's just so grand. There's no one there. And the journey, that 2 days across the Drake Passage, if you're travelling from South America, it's a hard journey. I mean, once you're down there, you really can't turn back. So if something goes wrong with your friends and family or yourself, you're not going to be able to get home easily. So you go through a psychological process to get down there. And then when you get down there, this scenery and the sounds and the sights are so massive and grand that I think it does change a lot of people after they've been down there.
But you get down there on a boat that's burning carbon.
Yes, that's the thing. And this is where this big dilemma comes in. I mean, many of the ships are now what they call hybrid ships. So they burn less carbon, but still they're burning a lot of carbon. And it's not just the ships, it's actually the plane flight to get to the ships that burns up a lot of carbon. And this is where we have this big juxtaposition or this big dilemma going on that, you know, we can take people down there and we can give them a profound experience that makes them realize that, yes, this world is changing and we need to change our behavior to protect our world. But at the same time, to get them down there, we have to do the thing that we're going down to learn, you know, is ruining the country, the earth. So it's a very, it's filled with contradictions.
But that's true of tourism everywhere, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, a plane to Paris burns an awful lot of carbon.
Yes, exactly. That's the problem. And so what we've been really doing is kind of looking at the growth of this industry and going, okay, if it burns a lot of carbon, can we, you know, what else comes out of it? Is there good that comes out of it? And also with this growth, can we try and encourage the form of tourism that is down there to be very respectful rather than becoming mass tourism? And that's kind of where our concerns and our research interests lie.
What does your research tell you about the impact of the people when they're there?
Our research tells us that for some people, it's a profound impact. So we know that a lot of people that already go down there are quite interested. So there's one segment that goes down there who are already interested in the environment, in the climate, and trying to sort of live a low-impact life. And what we see when we follow them over time, so we interview them before they've gone down, we interview them on the trip home when they're going north on the Drake Passage, and then months later. And what we can see is that some people actually change their behaviour. So they go home, the experience is so profound, they might start supporting an NGO, or they might start attending Antarctic events. So we can actually see that behaviour change occurs. But what we're worried about is that it doesn't always happen for all people, and it's also seems to be quite dependent on the style of tourism that's going on down there. And so that's where our interest lies, is how can we maximise the impact of this trip on people's behaviour when they go home?
But there's an earlier question, isn't there, which is how do we protect that environment from these people?
Yes.
Friends of mine were telling me that when they were going down there, even the Velcro straps on their shoes were scrubbed in case a tiny seed might be lodged there. What precautions are taken to make sure that anybody who's landing on the continent is clean?
They're amazing precautions, actually. And this is, one of these incredible things about Antarctica is that Antarctica is, governed by the Antarctic Treaty System. But the way in which tourism runs down there is regulated actually by the industry itself and through the International Association of tour operators. So that's called IATO. And they set regulations that require the companies to do that. I mean, you have to vacuum your clothes. You have to pick out the bottom of your boots that are provided to you by the company with a toothpick. And then you have to walk through a bath, just disinfect your shoes before you go to land on Antarctica. And you also, you have to pick the Velcro out. So, and many of the companies take this so seriously, and because of the seriousness of how they take it, they actually create sort of their own police force amongst the tourists who really take that activity quite seriously. And, you know, if they see someone who's not doing the right thing, they'll be like, oh, I've seen someone. So I think...
Dob them in.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's actually working really well. So...
But are those regulations actually enforced? I mean... Are people being punished who, or companies being punished that fail to live up to their obligations?
No, not so much. And I think that, you know, majority of the companies are pretty good, particularly the larger ones. It's probably what we see, you know, some of the problems are things like people who go down there in their yachts or perhaps companies
what,
that are
they
not...
sail down in their yachts?
Yes, they do. There's a lot of people who go down in their yachts.
They deserve the fate of Shackleton.
They do. Well, I mean, I just think it's unbelievable that they do it. But I think, you know, there are issues. I've been down there and seen human feces down there. And this summer there was actually graffiti that was put on one of the cultural heritage sites. So we are beginning to see these kind of transgressions, if you like, and almost environmental crimes. So that's one of the big problems. But like you mentioned before, the other problem is, you know, do we manage this place like a national park? So many national parks have places where they kind of say, okay, we'll kind of sacrifice that area. We'll allow visitors to go there and to see the magnificence of this place and how magnificent it is, but then we'll actually really protect other places. And that's what we're kind of, you know, looking at in Antarctica. At the moment, most of the tourism occurs in a small area. Like if you clenched your fist and you put your thumb up, the peninsula is really about kind of the size of your thumbnail when it comes out of your fist. And so there's a very small area where tourism
The fist being Antarctica.
That's right.
I shall never think of my fist the same way again. But isn't this the thin end of the wedge? I mean, when you start building facilities, they're forbidden at the moment, aren't they?
Correct. That's right. Yes. And what we're starting to see, and this is what happens in tourism, where it starts to grow, that in any other destination, it's not just, you know, Antarctica. But as it goes from niche to mass, you start to see kind of fudging around the edges. So at the moment, you're not allowed to have accommodation down there. But we're starting to see scientific structures used for tourism accommodation. We're starting to see the diversification of the industry. So you can go down there on a, you know, there was like a swingers cruise. There was a, you can go on a dentist's leadership cruise. You can go on, you know, all these themed cruises. You can do marathons down there or ocean
yes,
swimming.
Marathons.
Yes.
Again, friends of mine were with a marathon group and they would go off. They weren't able to actually run for 26 miles across the ice, but they ran round and round and round all day on the ice.
Exactly.
You also mentioned LGBTQ plus groups.
Yes.
What do they do on the ice?
Well, I haven't been on the trips down there, so I can't really say, but I do know there was also a doof doof cruise. But I mean, it's a doof doof cruise, like a disc, you know, like doof doof music. So,
oh, hell.
So I think for me, you know, with the LGBTQ plus cruise, that's probably just for those people to feel safe, and that's fair enough. I kind of get that. But what we worry is that the values are being eroded. So if the cruise is not centered around education and teaching people about the values of Antarctica, that's when we start to get worried. So when the diversification occurs, it makes us worry that perhaps the cruises are not really there for education. Maybe they're more just to kind of like satisfy egos and for hedonistic you know, reasons.
And therefore you fear that people will be more careless.
That's right. And the values of Antarctica are eroded. So, you know, it might be that they're still very good with picking the bits of, you know, dust out of their Velcro.
Well, LGBTQ plus, of course, perfect in that.
Absolutely. But not their, that I want to...
Their Velcro management is renowned.
That's right. But it's the values that we worry about. Because once you start thinking, oh, you know, it's like Venice. There's just so many people there. And what we know is those social norms affect the way in which people behave at destinations. So if we start to kind of think of something as ruined, then we might actually treat it as if it's ruined. And that's what we don't want to happen with Antarctica.
I'm talking to Anne Hardy, Professor of Tourism and Society at the University of Tasmania. And there's also the boats themselves. One of the fears, I understand, is smoke from the boats.
That's right. So cruise ships are well known for the fumes that come out of them and the impacts that they can cause. The good thing about the Antarctic tourism industry is that they are, you know, bringing in ships that really do reduce the amount of emissions, but they're hybrid ships that kind of run on this sort of hybrid fuel and electricity, so they're very quiet and they don't put off enough as much emissions. But there are still ships that are going down there where, you know, black fume is coming off and the concern is that that is going to actually, you know, land on the ice and have impacts in that way as well. So
among the early boats, as I understand it, that got tourists down there were ex-Soviet icebreakers. Now they're going to be filthy as.
Absolutely. There's still a few down there, I believe. They're slowly being phased out and the operators, I think most of them are fairly uncomfortable with using them now. But yes, they were very much that's how tourism began down there on a lot of it, you know, the popular form of cruise tourism began on those Russian icebreakers.
There's also the question of global warming. The area becomes more vulnerable, doesn't it, the warmer it gets?
Yes, that's right. So, the problem is that with global warming, that it actually increases the risk because you've got large glaciers down there and you've also got icebergs. There's actually a massive iceberg at the moment heading towards South Georgia. I can't remember the name. It's like A something or other. And so what you see as the water warms...
I think it's A23A.
Thank you very much.
No.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Probably right. So, and so with that is risk because when a glacier calves, there's a big wave that comes off and that can actually tip over a zodiac and the water down there is only sort of 0, 1, 2 degrees. And you don't live for very long when you're flipped over from a glacier calving and a little wave coming off it. So it increases the risk for visitors
But that's only going to increase the allure of the Antarctic, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the problem with tourism, isn't it? Because when you think about why we travel, like if you get to the core of why we travel, many of us travel for kind of ego and to prove ourselves or to show that we've done something that's interesting and to differentiate ourselves from our peers.
There's a lot of walking across Dorset at the moment, for instance.
Yes. Well, that's right. I didn't know about the walking across Dorset.
Yeah. Yes. It's everywhere.
Yes, yeah. So, and that's the thing is that, you know, for people who are just going down there to step on the continent, to touch it, wave the flag and go home, it doesn't really line up with the values of Antarctica being all about, you know, science and research. So that's what those people, we want to turn them into environmental advocates when they go home. Mm. And we can do that.
But you can't really vet the motives of the people who want to go down there, can you? I mean...
No.
What are the values of Antarctica? When I was a kid, it was heroic tragedy, wasn't it?
Yes, totally.
It was Shackleton's boat being crushed in the ice. It was It was somebody going out, and I may be a little time. It was Scott. It was death.
Mawson eating his dog, I think, wasn't it? And or they used to get vitamin poisoning for
the livers.
Yes, that's right.
I have known since I was about 8 years old. not to eat the liver of a sled dog.
That's right, exactly. We all grew up, well, many of us in the kind of, you know, that Anglo-Saxon world. We grew
up with
these stories.
Oh, it was really imperial, wasn't it? It's
very
really imperial.
Very much. And that's, you know, that's one of the problems with it. It's this imperial white conquest sort of storylines that go with it. And that it's a very, you know, people are very much motivated still by those stories, and they are absolutely incredible stories. But what we want to do is to maintain, you know, Antarctica being known as a very difficult place to get to, a very special place, and also the place where we really see the impacts of climate change. So if people can go down there and really see it for themselves, then that is probably got more likelihood of changing their behaviour afterwards. We can't change their motives, but we can actually change their behaviour afterwards to some extent if we can provide them with great education about the values of Antarctica.
We'll spend all that money, we'll endure the greatest seasick passage in the world, and when we get there, we will become better people.
I would hope so. That's my goal.
Anne, we're with you at Late Night Live. I've been talking to Anne Hardy, who is the Professor of Tourism and Society at the University of Tasmania. She is also Chair of Destination Southern Tasmania. And she is investigating the impact of these hundreds of thousands of human beings who are suddenly turning up on the coldest shelf of land on Earth. And thanks so much for joining us
on
Late Night Live.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, absolute pleasure.
Coming up, the lives Shakespeare's women might have lived. Dame Harriet Walter is known to the world as the basilisk-faced mother of Logan Roy's appalling brood of children, but she was famous, acclaimed, and awarded long before Succession's first season in 2018. In Britain and from time to time on Broadway, Harriet Walter is recognised as one of the finest Shakespearean actors of her generation. Now, I can't say this list is complete, and I know she'll correct me if I'm wrong, but she's played Cleopatra, Imogen, Portia, Lady Macbeth, wait for it, Prospero, Brutus, Henry IV, Ophelia, and, playing the saxophone at the age of 18, Mistress Quickly, something I need to ask her about in a moment. Though she acknowledges Shakespeare is, and I quote her, the poet of all our humanity, Harriet Walter has come to feel he never gave women their due. So she has, in her latest book, she speaks what Shakespeare's women might have said. It is outrageous and funny and wise. It's a meditation on Shakespeare, the thesis on acting, and a ghost memoir of its author, Harriet Walter. Harriet, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much for that introduction.
It was a bit long, wasn't it? Went on.
I loved it. I could have heard more.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, look, I'll rev up and do a bit more later. Your first Shakespeare, how old were you when you were taken to a theatre and you saw Shakespeare?
I saw Judi Dench playing Juliet, and I would have been 9, something like that. And then I saw Vanessa Redgrave in As You Like It. And I have very vivid memories of the women, those two women. Don't remember much else about anything else. I remember people's voices and I remember the set, but I had no clue what the story was.
Had you kind of come to the notion that you were going to be an actor?
Funnily enough, you've just put two memories together, because my first sort of knowing pronouncement that I was going to be an actress was around that time, now I come to think of it, but not as a result of seeing Judi Dench in a proper play, but seeing Hayley Mills in The Parent Trap on screen. That's what did it for me. But funnily enough, you've just put, I suppose I was at the same sort of age. I didn't tie up what Judi Dench was doing on stage with what I wanted to do, which was I just wanted to be watched by a lot of people and escape and pretend to be somebody else. And that's not quite what she was doing.
I get the sense that the role that made all the difference for you was playing Ophelia when you were about 30?
Yeah, I guess I was there.
Why
coming up to
30. Was that? Why was that a sort of, it seemed a big step through the door into big theatre?
I think what had happened was I was gently slid into Shakespeare rather than having some great big sudden mountain to climb, because I'd just done a television film written by Ian McEwan, directed by Richard Eyre, about a young woman who was sort of going a bit potty because she knew too much during the war. And she was imprisoned for the duration because she'd sort of stepped out of line in a very secret atmosphere, which was necessary during the war, and very patriarchal world where she wasn't able to express herself. And so there I was playing this part, and Richard Eyre was about to direct Jonathan Pryce's Hamlet at the Royal Court, and he was thinking, I wonder who should play Ophelia. I've got her sitting here in front of me, because the character was rather similar. So having just played this sort of character...
What was the name of the film?
It was called The Imitation Game, long before the big movie that Benedict Cumberbatch and people did. Mm-hmm. But because it was... in the same territory. It was about the sort of Bletchley people and Turing and all those people. It was sort of on that theme. It's an interesting piece. But anyway, what I mean is that I didn't, because it was the same director and some of the cast were the same, it felt like an easing into the world of Shakespeare. And also it was the Royal Court. It wasn't the Old Vic or the RSC. It was the Royal Court, which I'd worked in before. I don't know, it just felt less scary than it could have been.
But you write about working out for yourself a kind of backstory for Ophelia, fleshing out her life in your own mind, but not letting on to the audience about any of that, holding it in.
Yeah. I mean,
What's that about?
I think I didn't know how to rehearse. You know, this was my first big cheese production in the middle of London and with proper actors that were famous. And, you know, I'd spent 5 or 6 years on the fringe doing political theatre and experimental theatre and running around England in a van and putting the set up that night and taking it down at the end of the evening with people all of my age group and my peer group, none of us famous. And then suddenly I'm putting...
David Hare writes about that kind of van theatre. Mm. It wasn't anything to do with the playwright David Hare, was it?
Well, David Hare was a director of Joint Stock, along with William Gaskell and Max Stafford Clarke, who go on to be big cheeses, but at the time they weren't big cheeses.
Well, you're going on to be a big cheese yourself, but it's as Ophelia,
mm-hmm.
working out this whole life for her.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I didn't dare put it in front of anybody else. Rehearsals are the most scary bit about acting, because you're getting it wrong in front of your peer group or your betters within your peer group. And you're getting it wrong because by definition, rehearsing means you do it wrong a lot of times before you do it right. And by the time you get in front of an audience, you've worked out how to do it and someone's patted you on the back and said you're in the right direction. But when you're rehearsing, you haven't a clue where you're going. And I'd never rehearsed in a company like that. And so, plus, we only had in those days, believe it or not, something like 3.5 weeks rehearsal.
Ooh.
And if the bulk of it is dealing with Jonathan Pryce playing Hamlet, you're not going to get a lot of time practicing your few scenes. Sort of once a week you'd come in and do a bit. And the rest of the time, out of sheer terror, I was working something up at home, because I had to have something going on. And then she has this mad scene where she's talking nonsense and you've got to work out what that nonsense means. But the thing about acting is you're not supposed to demonstrate, you're supposed to just inhabit and let other people read you if they can. It was my first practice in that, of knowing exactly what was going on inside my head. And if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't, you know, to the audience. And it's a good feeling. It's a good feeling having a secret from the audience.
And 1 or 2 years down the track, you've put these stories into verse,
mm-hmm.
in a book.
Mm-hmm.
the things that Shakespeare didn't write.
That's right. I love the one or two. It's more like five decades. But
and it is enormously funny and also satisfying. I mean, tell us about Gertrude, the real life of Gertrude. Now I finally understand it. I never really understood what a dreadful position that woman was in.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's still up for grabs. I'm not tying anything up. Come on, everyone's going to be able to chuck this out the window if they read it and say, well, that's one interpretation of zillions, because that's the way it works. But I just watch so many Gertrudes floundering on stage, not having any lines to come back at this sort of overgrown teenager.
Mr. Hamlet,
who's sort of really very immature, still blaming his parents for everything and women in general for most things, and not coming to terms with himself and yet being absolutely brilliant. Of course, he's a wonderful character as well, but he's that mixture. And the way he behaves with his mother is a spoilt child, really, is sort of... and he accuses her of, you know, how can you possibly fall in love with that ghastly man, my uncle, only a few months after you've wept at my father's funeral, and, you know, that wonderful man who was my father. And she says he wasn't wonderful at all. You know, you've got it all wrong. You've got it back to front.
He was a beast.
Yeah, me and Claudius were in love ages and ages before anything happened. And your parents forced me to marry the older brother. And neither, we didn't like one another. We didn't get on. We produced you and then full stop. And, you know, he was a martinet and, absolutely impossible man. And, of course, I can't tell you that. You know, when I say what Shakespeare's women might have said, it's also what they can't say sometimes. But she can't say it to him because it would break his heart. To learn that this idol was actually rather awful and violent.
And so there it is in your book. She speaks, and it's the backstories that you give to these characters. And as I say, they're extraordinarily, they're funny, but they're also very wise. I love the fact that you found Cleopatra rather a bore. Why?
She's just a narcissist, really, and she can't really function unless she's got an audience. So she's either got the audience that's out there, you know, the real rabble at the Globe Theatre or whatever, but she's also got all her servants on stage and you know, obviously Roman soldiers and people she's impressed over the years and Antony himself. And he's almost writing a piece about a theatrical couple who know about their own importance and know about their star quality.
And live in public.
They live in public and they have star quality, and their reputation and their image is what's at stake. And of course I'm reducing it, you know, but there is an element whereby they have a sense of their own grandeur and a sense of their, you know, they belong in the panoply of the stars in heaven, you know, and their lives are consequential, you know, what they do is sort of reverberates around the world. So they've got massive, massive egos, and they actually don't spend very much time on stage together. And when they do, they're usually shouting at one another and annoying one another and trying to bring back the past, but it's gone.
And when Cleopatra and Antony are reunited, Harriet, you've got the book in front of you.
Yes.
Cleopatra's rather disillusioned speech when she finds herself in heaven with Antony. Mm-hmm. I think we should have a burst of that, don't
Let's
you?
Let's give her a burst. I must say, when I was a child and people said you went to heaven, I thought, how boring.
It's always been a bit
all
boring,
white,
hasn't it?
And empty and white clouds.
It's perhaps better than hell, though.
I suppose so. I'd rather just die, actually.
Give us a burst of Cleopatra.
Okay. It's called Another Dreary Day in Heaven. How tedious this eternity can be in close proximity with Antony, who once crossed mighty oceans in his stride, now curls up safe and cozy by my side. In life, I longed for him, but now, Oh, hum. As Cressid rightly said, things won are done. What's love bereft of parting's sweetest sorrow, without the fear of losing him tomorrow? My asp bite and his wounds are long since healed, and all our fruits and grapes come ready peeled. Without command and sway and sexual sizzle, it's all one dreary democratic drizzle. This endless flowing cloudscape is so bland. My monument has crumbled into sand. Death killed my rule, but not my self-regard. Without an audience, I find life hard. I miss the thrill of being centre stage, where slaves and emperors cowered at my rage, where nature's peaks and troughs, its fires and floods, reflected all the grandeur of my moods. Now, from my cloudy cushion, I survey Earth's pygmy players acting out a play in which I am portrayed as sly and willful, not as I was, politically skillful. As I predicted, squeaking Cleopatras parade my shame with shambling hammy partners pretending to be Antony and fail to match our mythic stature and our scale. My pride and reputation are at stake. It took some guts to suckle that damn snake. I cannot bear to watch as wanton boys belittle my brave death with bendy toys. This Mr. William Shakespeare, who is he that he will dare to make a fool of me?
I'm talking to Harriet Walter about her new book, She Speaks, What Shakespeare's Women Might Have Said. Harriet, can I defend Shakespeare for a moment? Mm. I mean, can I give it a go? He wrote wonderful parts for women.
He did.
He understood women.
Yep.
And yet, you've got it in for him about women. I mean, think of the women that he has created, and yet you count the lines, you count the scenes, and there aren't enough of either.
Okay, let me make my position clear. He didn't write less well for women. He wrote astonishingly beautifully for women. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gone on doing it all this time. He understood women because he understood humanity. And when women talk about war or fear or love or distress or jealousy or excitement, there's nothing to parallel him. The only quarrel I have is not with Shakespeare, but with the times he was living in, where women didn't get to motor the engine of the plot, either on stage or off. And plots were built around men. And women were in the story in as much as they were related to the men. I challenge you to find a female character who isn't the mother, wife, daughter, or sister of any other character. It's quite difficult to find, unless you're a servant or something like that, or maybe the nurse in Romeo and Juliet. There are, of course, there are some. But mostly the women are there because they are related to the central man in some way. And that's their purpose in the plot. They're not there in their own right to run the show, apart from a very few exceptions, like Rosalind in As You Like It, who's the biggest part for a woman. And counting the lines, I didn't personally count the lines. This is from a chart that's out there on the web. And it's it gives all the Shakespeare's roles in order of size, according to the number of lines they have. And in the first 100 parts, there are only 15 women.
Those parts, those women's parts, were played by boys and young men. And you have a fascinating argument about what that allowed Shakespeare to do.
Yes, it's just a theory that if he'd been writing for women, the parts would be more limited, because I think the boys were allowed to be, they could be a bit, they could deliver a little sexual innuendo, they could be bold and feisty and argumentative and funny and physical in a way that if he'd been writing for lady players. He might have felt, because he was an audience pleaser, but first and foremost, and it would have been a big jolt to see women on stage, and he'd have to go about it very decorously and delicately, I think. And even when women did come onto the stage some 50 years later, they were always involved in love affairs. You know, they weren't taking big moral decisions or leading armies or doing all the things that we find really dramatic.
So being boys, they could be naughtier.
They could be naughtier.
On stage.
Yeah, I think.
But did it also mean that Shakespeare was dealing with inexperienced actors, beginners? The women were always played by beginners.
Yes, but I think they're very, you know, you look at children now, there are some young actors who, you see these wonderful young actors, don't you? What's humiliating for an old lag like me is that very young people can just get it and do it brilliantly. And
instinctively.
There's nothing I can teach you. You're just brilliant. And why shouldn't that have been true then? But I also think we have to remember that theatre as an art form was pretty young, and it wasn't that London was full of fantastically brilliant actors. There wasn't a pool of, you know, top grade RSC actors. You know, it was who was free and who was available and who was willing and who had a nice voice. And, you know, people were being trained up in a fairly new profession.
Mm. And you say that Shakespeare takes seriously the possibilities of love between men, but he does not take seriously the possibilities of love between women.
That's right. And again, I'm not blaming Shakespeare, because that is just prevalent. And that's prevalent until the last century, really, when people started to admit that there was a thing called lesbianism, or, you know, physical love between women. From the male point of view, women couldn't possibly have had sex because they didn't have penises, and therefore how could they have any pleasure? Because we're the only ones who can give women pleasure.
We're the kings of pleasure, yeah. Yes.
So there was that underlying something, and also that, you know, it was always acceptable for girls to be physically affectionate with one another and touchy-feely with one another. And so when that stepped over into actual mature physical love, it was private and unnoticed, and people, it didn't jump out at people. So I think that, you know, all through Victorian times, there were lots of women living together, but nobody sort of defined it in any way. Nobody even sort of wrote about it or talked about it.
You say of Shakespeare that he teaches actors how to perform his work. How?
Oh, gosh, it's hard to demonstrate that here. But there's something. There are so many ways in which there are clues in the text as to what's going on, that it's like you begin to, it's like sort of when you get to know a crossword setter and you start to sort of know what the clues are and how his mind works. You start to understand how his mind works and how, what he's trying to tell you, what he wants you to pick up on. He doesn't do stage directions, but the stage directions are in the language, the way, whether he uses monosyllables, like when, you know, it's just in the rhythm when you say to be or not to be, or if it were done, when t'were done, you know, t'were well, it were done quickly. It's all the monosyllables that the kind rhythm. Of tell you, the rhythm tells you there's only one way to think this line, really. It's very hard to answer your question without the room. You know, I'd have to sort of do a masterclass on it, really.
Yes. No, look, I just picked it up from the text, this notion that you are safe in his hands. Mm. Yes.
Yes. I mean, one of the examples I've given is that if you're playing Imogen in Cymbeline, which very few people do because it's not a play that's done often, but there's this scene where she is drugged. Everyone thinks she's dead and they lay her in a grave, and right next to her is her decapitated husband, she thinks, another corpse without a head. as it happens, the audience knows that it isn't. It's the decapitated body of the absolute idiot Cloten, who nobody cares about. So nobody's sad about it, but you have to wake up from your woozy sleep, grope around like people do in films when their lover's left and they've got a hollow pillow next to them.
One of the greatest cliches of film. The big cliche, bed, yes.
Where is he? And she gropes around and she finds this horrific thing lying next to her, wearing her husband's clothes. So she presumes she doesn't. It's one of those terrible stretches of disbelief, you know, where she thinks that this is her husband who's dead. And you go, well, what would you do and what would you say? I mean, and in a modern play, I'd have to think of all that and I'd have to act it out and I'd have to, you know, come up with something. But Shakespeare just says, I hope I dream.
As simple as that.
And he's told me how to do it. That's what I mean.
How is it that we can be on the edge of our chairs, perhaps even on the edge of tears, watching a great performance of Shakespeare, but we know how it ends? How it ends isn't the point. How is that?
I think that's really important because what I've been saying with all of this and the book is that the arias and the music within the play are what I love. The actual plot is often really ridiculous. And, so the plot isn't the thing that matters to us. It probably did to his audiences. The plot was really important. And they would recognize all sorts of situations that we don't any longer hold, you know, like particularly in the area of relationship of women, where, you know, daughters were totally subservient to their fathers or their husbands. And, you know, we don't buy that anymore, although it still exists. We don't buy it. And in his day, that would have been, you know, quite normal, you know. And we can't take plots like The Taming of the Shrew and, you know, we just can't swallow them in the way his audiences would have.
Merchant of Venice.
Or The Merchant of Venice. Problems. We question all these things now. Whereas in his day, it was a jolly good, ripping good yarn. And within that yarn, he could create this wonderful poetry. And I don't mean poetry sort of florid language tacked on the top. I mean, you know, gutsy stuff that comes out of you because you're trying to persuade somebody something, or you're trying to threaten somebody, or you're trying to woo somebody, or you're trying to win an argument. There's a real purpose behind the poetry. And, you know, it moves us. I think it's like music. It just, you know, you go, oh, there's that passage I love. Oh, you've heard it a million times and you know that it's some very unrealistic opera plot.
Doesn't matter.
You love, you know, it just chimes something in your heart and who knows how that happens. It's a miracle. It's wonderful.
The miracle that happens over and over and over and over again. You talk about the central paradox of live performance. The actor is in one time and place, the character is in another, and the audience is with the character or the actor?
That's a very good question. Yes, I think the audience is with the character, if you're doing your job well. You're trying to take them across time into your predicament, particularly with soliloquies where people appeal to the audience. They say, you know, I draw the example of Isabella in Measure for Measure, leaning out to the audience and saying, to whom should I complain? Did I tell this? Who would believe me?
She's been abused.
And she's been abused. And the audience have seen it. The audience have seen it. And she's saying, who can I talk to about this? And they're crying out, us, tell us, we believe you. But she's saying, I can't come to you. I'm stuck in this play in 16th century Vienna and I can't shift because this is my plight. And that's the paradox, is that the actor knows that they're actually in the present day and they're going to have supper after the play's over. The audience knows on one level that the actor's going to have supper after the play's over. Mm. But the whole conspiracy of theatre is that we believe that we're in 16th century Vienna and this woman is being abused. That's the magic of theatre. It's the willing suspension of disbelief.
And you point out that Shakespeare's soliloquies aren't just poetic vaporising, they're arguments.
Yeah. That's so important, I think, because I remember a bunch of sort of young students who were resisting going for the language. You know, they thought it was uncool and we don't talk like that anymore and we mumble and we elide words and we you know, poetry's unfashionable and sounds silly and unnatural and they thought of it as decorative and florid and why say it that way when you could just say, instead of to be or not to be, what that is the question, whether it is nobler in the mind, blah, blah, blah. Why don't they just say, shall I kill myself or shan't I? Full stop.
Yeah? Yes.
They cut to the chase. Well, you'd miss a whole lot of stuff on the way to that. And so I was trying to win them over to the idea that language is that there's an argument going on, even if you're just arguing with yourself in a soliloquy. And that's what gives the whole thing fire and fuel and energy, is that you're going, I think this, but I also think that. And so even if it's put in a poetic, beautiful way using imagery, the imagery isn't there to show off, look what a clever poet I am.
But to
it's
drive.
It's there to drive you and to move you and to be specific. That's the other thing. So no emotion should be generalised. It should be very specific. Things like that.
Harriet, this has been wonderful. I want you to read what I think is the most beautiful sonnet in the book. And this is your meditation on The Tempest, Ariel in The Tempest, because it is also the most beautiful meditation on acting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. This is Ariel's sonnet.
By Harriet Walter.
Hattie Walter. Much as an actor hides behind a role, avoiding capture, so I shift my shape. A paradox who's never truly whole, belonging nowhere, longing to escape. I wear a coat of other people's skins, clap on the helmet of my master's thoughts, not sure where his path ends or mine begins, an aerial pet performing somersaults. I zip around the island, flame the sea, dive deep inside the core of spinning earth, paint music in the air where thought is free. But love doth make me ask, what's freedom worth? Unchained from him who loves me, I do fear that loosed to viewless winds, I'll disappear.
I doubt it somehow.
Now, I didn't invent viewless winds, by the way. I'm sure the listener will know that comes from Measure for Measure.
And but here and there, Shakespeare's own words are given italics.
Yeah.
So there should be no mistakes whatever. But that's very beautiful.
Thank you very much.
Not even beautiful, but just wise.
Thank you.
Harriet, thank you so much for
joining
us on Late Night Live.
Lovely.
You are at the Writers' Festival on Wednesday night.
That's
is that
right.
correct?
Exactly correct.
Right.
Loving every minute. Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming to Australia for this little gig. I have been talking to Harriet Walter about her new book, her fifth, I believe. She Speaks, What Shakespeare's Women Might Have Said. Published absolutely, obviously, by Virago. And that's the show. Now, take heart, Late Night Live is not deserting you on Christmas Day, afternoon or night. As a special treat, we're replaying my interview with Laura Tingle as she prepared to leave Canberra and us behind to take on the world for the ABC. And for nostalgia's sake, we revisit the open-air cinemas of Australia, some of them still going strong. ¶¶